If you love Claude Monet's water lilies, you'll probably be amazed to find out that these eight giant water lily murals that came to define his career ever came to be in the first place. Produced late in his life, Monet was struggling with cataracts and with personal loss. He struggled with the idea of ever painting again. But he did, even with the encroachment of World War I. Ross King has captured this story in a new book, Mad Enchantment, Claude Monet and the Painting of the Water Lilies. Ross King has produced books on Da Vinci and Michelangelo. He speaks at the Kansas City Public Library tonight, and so nice to have you, Ross. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Well, you've written these books on our great artists and their greatest works, Michelangelo and the ceiling of the newly restored Sistine Chapel, Da Vinci and his Last Supper. Now you've taken on Monet and his water lilies. Which was, well, was the greatest feat of all of those?
Well, it's difficult to compare them. Maybe you could take size as a as the best comparative, in which case Monet wins hands down because mm-hmm. he painted an even greater surface with water lilies than Michelangelo did in the Sistine Chapel. But I think it's difficult to compare things that came from different centuries and were done in different techniques. They're all remarkable feats in their own right. And I think what I wanted to do in each of the cases was to drill down deeply into those years in which, whether it was Michelangelo or Monet, spent working, dealing with political events, historical events, dealing with personal battles on these works of art, which we now tend to think of as, quite rightly, as masterpieces and things that have become icons of Western art. And I think because they're such icons, we tend to think, of course, Leonardo da Vinci was always going to make a success of the Last Supper. Of course, Michelangelo was going to do a wonderful job in the Sistine Chapel. And of course, Claude Monet could paint the water lilies. But in fact, when you look much more closely at the circumstances, the personal circumstances of these men when they started working on them, or when you look at the times in which they did it, which were often very tumultuous politically and even dangerous in some cases, it makes us appreciate that these works were a kind of process undertaken at very particular points by people who you might not have picked to do those jobs in the first place.
Well, you talk about Monet being in such bad shape in 1914, Ross, when he went to work on the lilies and his final great work. He had to overcome so much, and one thing he had overcome was just the notion that this was the masterpiece he produced late in his life. Typically, you think of these things coming earlier.
That's right. Monet had had a long career. He was in his mid-70s when he began painting the large-scale water lilies. And he was, by this point, almost the last of the Impressionists. In fact, in 1926, he would be the last of them to die. Renoir died in 1919, Degas in 1917. And so Monet really was the last man standing. But by his early 70s, he really thought that he had done everything that he was capable of doing. But sadly, not everything he wanted to do. In 1913, he effectively retired. At the age of 72, he retired his brushes because of what he felt was his deteriorating eyesight, and also the fact that his beloved wife, his second wife, Elise, had died in 1911.
He lost a son, too.
That's right. Early in 1914, his eldest son, he had two boys, his eldest son, Jean, died at the age of 46. And so Monet, in 1914, was in mourning for his wife and for his son, and he was also plagued with cataracts, and I think also with artistic self-doubts, because mm-hmm. I think he wasn't sure that Impressionism would stand the test of time, because, of course, by the 20th century, the first decade or two of the 20th century, there was a new threat to Impressionism through people like Henri Matisse and Pablo Picasso, who were painting, especially in the case of Picasso, in a very different style. Yeah. And younger art critics, younger painters, no longer looked to old man Monet for their inspiration as previous generations had. And this new generation was rising up.
Talk to us about his eyesight, because his contemporaries thought he had extraordinary eyesight, Ross. Was it Cézanne thought maybe he could see things that other people could not? And yet he's at the point in his life when he's beginning this masterwork and his eyesight is failing. That must have been just an incredible blow to him.
That's right. I think it's terrible for anyone who starts losing their eyesight, maybe especially worse for painters who maybe have a greater visual appreciation and whose trade comes through their ability to see. And most difficult of all, I think, for Monet in 1912 when he first began having trouble with his eyes, because he was, as you say, regarded to have had the best eyes in the history of painting, maybe the best eyes in history, period. Because by the late 19th century, there was speculation in French newspapers that Monet was a sort of more highly evolved example of humanity, insofar as it was believed that he was extra sensitive to colors at the ultraviolet end of the spectrum. And Cézanne has a wonderful quote where he says, "Monet is only an eye, but my God, what an eye he is." And Monet's paintings were really built on his ability to perceive nuance and light and shade, and see these and then capture them with his paintbrushes.
In fact, if Monet was to meet you, when he sized you up, he really scrutinized you in a way that maybe was a little bit sort of took you down.
That's right. I think it was probably quite unsettling or disconcerting.
That's the word I was looking for.
I think an intimidating character. Not just he had a great physical presence, even though he was a smallish man, big bushy tobacco-stained beard. He was a chain smoker. He defied gravity in some ways in terms of his health, because he lived until 86, despite the fact that he was he chain smoked as he painted. And I've always wondered if you studied the pigments in his paintings closely enough, you would find a lot of cigarette ash had been flicked into it or something like that. Everyone noticed his eyes, because they were very, not only were they very acute in what they could see, but they, everyone described them, and they would really fix you. And I guess you wouldn't know if he was sizing you up for a portrait, or he was sizing you up because he thought you were an idiot, because he didn't say a lot. He was a man of few words, even among his friends. And yet he still was a very powerful and intimidating presence.
You know, he's going through all these difficulties and even struggling with this notion of whether he would ever paint again. But he had a friend, a very prominent friend, who helped keep his head on straight and helped him endure and proceed with the water lily paintings. Who was that friend?
That was Georges Clemenceau.
Mm-hmm.
Who was
a major character in the book.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Major character in the book, major character in French life. In fact, by about 1910, Clemenceau and Monet were a kind of double act, and they were virtually the same age. Monet was 1 year older. Monet was born in 1840. And they were really the two most famous Frenchmen. You can't really overstate. We're used to thinking of the Impressionists as scorned and derided. But Monet lived long enough to enjoy prosperity, great prosperity, and also great acclaim. And Clemenceau was probably the most famous politician in France. He had been prime minister from 1906 to 1909, and he would become prime minister again in 1917, very famously. Was really the one who encouraged Monet. It was really thanks to Clemenceau that Monet began painting again in 1914.
What did Clemenceau see in Monet that he wanted to spend so much time with him?
I think Monet didn't talk politics. And Clemenceau, he said Giverny is where he would come, where Monet lived. Giverny is my escape from politics. And Clemenceau in 1914 was a senator, a French senator, and also the editor and proprietor of a daily newspaper for which he wrote editorials. Mm. So he was very deeply immersed in French political life and all of these political battles. He was a battle-scarred veteran of decades worth of the political wars in France. And to de-stress and to come and talk about art, which Clemenceau was a very cultivated man and he loved art, he would come to Giverny and look at Monet's paintings. He loved Monet's paintings and thought he was the greatest painter in history. Eat Monet's food, which it was said that you got the best food in France at Monet's table. And they would do things like talk about books. They would stroll around the garden and enjoy mm-hmm. Monet's beautiful garden. And it was really his escape from everything else that really had taken over his life.
And did they both like fast cars?
They did, yes. Clemenceau they both had chauffeurs, and mm-hmm. Monet.
But they like to go fast, yeah.
Absolutely. Well, Monet got the first speeding ticket in Giverny in 1904. We might not think of Monet as a speed demon, but he loved fast cars. He would go to car races and watch the fireball cars tear around the countryside, and he himself would tear around the countryside in the latest vehicles. He had Peugeots and all of the latest French automobiles, as did his children. His children loved cars as well and bought and sold them.
Describe Giverny for us. What, 40, 60 miles outside of
Northwest of Paris, mm-hmm. In the Seine Valley. Everyone who arrived there said this is paradise. It was just the most beautiful village nestled in the Seine Valley. It was on another river, or a confluence of a couple of other rivers.
Is it still beautiful today?
It is still beautiful today. It has the beautiful old stone houses. It has, of course, Monet's house and garden, which still exist and are really much the same way they were in 1926 when he died, thanks to a restoration program over the past generation or two. You can stroll the streets that Monet strolled. And almost every corner, as you look off into the fields or up at the hills, you see a Monet painting. You see where he stood to paint the haystacks, or you go inside the garden and see his weeping willows and see the water lilies. And so it still is very much a magical place.
So why water lilies, Ross? What was it? Why did that subject grab him so that he wanted to make it the focus of his final push here?
Well, in some ways, that's a very good question. He painted a lot of motifs. His way of painting was to choose something over the course of a 2 or 3 year period, and then paint nothing but that. Mm-hmm. So many of your listeners, I'm sure, know his haystack paintings. And over the course of a year or two, he painted dozens and dozens of haystacks from every angle, from every season, every hour of the day. He did the same with poplars. He did the same with the Mornings on the Seine series that he did, where he sat in a boat at dawn and painted the River Seine in all its changing moods. And really, by about 1903, water lilies became the only thing that he was interested in painting. Or I should specify, water lilies in his pond at Giverny, also including some of the other flora that he had there, such as irises and weeping willows.
And he had many of those sort of brought in because they weren't indigenous to that area.
Exactly. He really first fell. No, it's not cheating. If it can be done, it's not cheating. And Monet loved them. Maybe the way to answer your question is to say that he fell in love in 1889 with colored water lilies, the water lilies with colored blooms. Previous to that, he had only seen, like everyone else in France, water lilies with white flowers. But someone had figured out how to cultivate, how to crossbreed the hardier Northern European water lily with the exotic specimens from Mexico or other places in Middle America to produce orange flowers, yellow flowers, blue flowers, red flowers. And Monet was stunned by this. He wasn't stunned by the Eiffel Tower, which was unveiled in the same year, 1889, but he was stunned by the water lilies at the Universal Exposition in 1889. And he wrote and said, this is a good motif for painting. And so he really began his water garden in Giverny in a couple of years later in 1893, spent 10 years perfecting it, putting in a Japanese bridge, putting in willow trees, putting in irises.
Half a dozen workers constantly tending to it, right?
That's right. He had a team of 6 gardeners. And I think you probably quaked in your boots if you were a young gardener and Monsieur Monet came down the path first thing in the morning to give you your marching orders
for
the day.
They had a name for him.
His wife called him Le Marquis, the Marquis, or the Marquis, because of his... they said he was like a country gentleman. He dressed in English tweeds. He developed a taste for marmalade and English tailoring when he was in, and also tea, Cardoma tea, on his various visits to England. And so he was regarded as being somewhat of an English lord or an aristocratic figure, and he had boots that came from the French cavalry, etc. So he was quite a stylish figure, and I think quite intimidating if you were maybe an 18-year-old gardener and it was your first day on the job and you were told to row out in a boat and dunk the water lilies to keep them, to get them fresh and clean because Monet wanted to paint them.
Ross King's my guest. His new book, Mad Enchantment, Claude Monet and the Painting of the Water Lilies. He'll be speaking this evening at 6:30 at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. The event is free, but go to kclibrary.org to reserve a seat. He often talked about, Ross, the light and how the light changed so dramatically where he lived. What kind of challenge did that pose for him, and how did he deal with that?
It posed a terrible challenge, and he didn't always deal with it that well. What I'm never sure how serious he was being when he said this, but he said the light changes every 7 minutes. And so what he really wanted to do with his paintings is paint every minute of the day. And so every 7 minutes, presumably, he changed canvases. And there are many eyewitness accounts of seeing Monet painting by the seashore, painting in a meadow, with 5, 6, 7, 8 canvases by his side. And every few minutes, he would swap over to a new one and begin painting as the light changed. And there are also very funny stories of how he raged at the tide, because the tide on the Normandy coast wasn't behaving the way that he wanted.
He can't, even Monet couldn't control that.
That's right. Not even Monet could turn back the tide. And so he, in many ways, he set himself an impossible task, which was to capture light, shade, reflection, sparkles, all of these things which are intangible and also fleeting, because they were always changing. And his friend, one of his friends, called his water lily pond the luminous abyss into which Monet stared day after day, week after week, ultimately month after month and year after year, almost driving himself crazy as he stared at the reflections and tried to capture it on canvas. And when he didn't capture it according to his own very high standards, he would physically attack his canvases.
We're talking violence here.
That's right. I think of him, if your listeners remember Fawlty Towers, I think of him as the Basil Fawlty of painting, and he would give a good thrashing to his canvases.
Or Norman Bates.
Exactly. Well, and he would physically attack them with a knife. His wife would say, oh, Claude is puncturing canvases every day. He ripped them up. He stomped on them. In one point, he went to Norway in 1895 because he wanted to paint snow, and he had a stepson living there that he was visiting. And a Norwegian art critic went to see the great Monet painting in the snow and was treated to the unedifying spectacle of the great Monet stomping on his paintings in the snow, in a snowbank. And he also set fire to paintings.
Pick your poison here.
Exactly. Yeah. Every artist edits their work, and everything you do isn't good. But I think the difference with Monet is the physical intensity and violence with which he attacked his canvases. And he flew into these dreadful rages. Clemenceau called him King of the Grouches because he thought he was... Clemenceau said, I picture you picking a fight with the sun, that Monet raged against the elements like King Lear when they didn't behave according to the way that he wanted them to.
You know, describe for us, if you would, Ross, the challenge that Monet took on at this point in life, the level of degree of difficulty he took on to push ahead and do this series of murals. I mean, you know, some people might take them for granted today, but this is regarded how in the art world today?
Well, I think they're as important to 20th century art as Impressionism, which he was very involved with 50 years earlier, was to 19th century art. Because I was talking about how we think of these things become iconic, and we lose sight of what actually went into the making of them and what's so special about them. And those, when I write about his water lilies, I'm specifically talking about the ones he did in the last dozen years of his life from 1914 to 26, which are the big ones. And so the perfect example in Kansas City at the Nelson Atkins is part of that Agapanthus triptych, which anyone who's seen it knows it's a massive canvas. It's 14 feet wide, it's 6.5 feet high. And that's just a mere fraction of everything he produced during those years. He produced literally hundreds of yards of canvas, hundreds of square feet of canvas, at a time when he was in his 70s and 80s, when his eyesight was failing, when World War I was raging, and when, as we've been speaking about, he was in mourning for his wife and his son.
So he worked quickly.
He did work quickly, but one of the fallacies about Monet is that he was a one-shot painter who had set up his easel in the countryside and dash off a painting in whatever it took, 20 minutes, 2 hours, something like that.
He would produce one painting every 2 days is what you wrote.
That's right. But in some ways, that was the first draft of the paintings, because all of his paintings look very natural and look like they've been quickly and easily painted. But in fact, that's deceptive, because when he did a painting in 2 days, he would often then go back to it. And some of his paintings, especially the water lily paintings, he worked and reworked and reworked again. Some of the water lilies have 15 layers of paint on them. I mean, a friend of his who watched him paint many times said that he would sometimes spend as much as 60 sessions on a single painting. And so that's not really how we think of it. That's how we think of someone like Leonardo da Vinci painting, doing layer upon layer of paint. We think of Monet working much more quickly. And he certainly made his studies very quickly, but those finished paintings took many, many hours, if not days and weeks of effort.
I bet after 3 years of spending your life with him and researching what you could, there are things you would just die to ask him.
Absolutely. The grand scheme of things, this may seem like a small query, but one of the things I was so curious about as I was working on the book is whether he went to the Western Front in 1917, because he was hired to paint on the Western Front, which was going to be a great propaganda tool for the French government, to have the great landscapist and interpreter of cathedrals and things like that, Claude Monet, go and show what the Germans were doing to the landscape. I think it's unlikely that he went, on balance of things, but he claimed he did, and I found another source that claimed that he did. So I may well feel obligated to give him the benefit of the doubt. Mm-hmm. But I'd love to talk to him about that experience, because he was someone who loved the French landscape and was, as I say, the most sensitive interpreter of it. And yet he would have gone 100 miles from Giverny, less than 100 miles from Giverny, which was radiantly beautiful, and he would have seen this unparalleled destruction, destruction of the French countryside, something that had never happened before. And how did he feel about humanity? How did he feel about the landscape? A lot of landscapists who were hired as painters by their governments, by the British government, American government, Canadian government in World War I, could not paint landscapes after the war, simply because the sort of magic of the landscape, which they often regarded as a kind of bond with God in this landscape tradition, that had been severed. And so I would just like to talk to Monet about what was his response to seeing the terrible devastation of the French countryside.
But given what you've said about him, you wonder how good of an interview he'd be.
He would be monosyllabic, I think, and yes. And he might say, next question, please, quite quickly.
How difficult was it to go back that far and research his life?
It was not that. I've worked a lot in the 15th century, so compared to that, it was quite easy. Yeah. And I was very fortunate insofar as the Bibliothèque Nationale, the great state library in France, has put a lot of material online, not so much material specifically on Monet, but all of the newspapers. And so I was able to call up, sitting at home in front of my computer, I was able to call up through this wondrous service that they have made called Gallica, and I was able to read the newspaper. So I could read, for example, I found that Monet in 1918 was put a want ad in one of the French newspapers looking for a cook because his cook had left. And so I was able to find all sorts of little trivia just through searching through the French newspapers, all of which made it such a great pleasure. I was able to sort of immerse myself in the culture of the time.
Tell us a little more about the town where you live. Can you describe it to us?
Well, you can reach it quite easily from Paris. You can do a day trip from Paris very quickly and easily. And when you go, you'll probably, depending on the time of the year, probably join a large lineup of people waiting to get into Monet's house and garden. Just be reassured, it does move quite quickly, so you will get in. And when you're in the garden, you'll get to see exactly what Monet saw and painted. I think Monet was not a spiritual person, but I find it a spiritual place because I think the old codger is still there. His spirit is still there with us.
Ross King's new book, fascinating conversation. His new book, Mad Enchantment, Claude Monet and the Painting of the Water Lilies. Again, you can see and hear him this evening at 6:30 at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. It's a free event. Go to kclibrary.org for more information. The event co-sponsored by Rainy Day Books and Fairway. And Ross, what a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks.
Interesting
for
topic
here.
And a topic that endures, unlike the political conversations of today. This one will be around for a while.
Absolutely. Wonderful guy, Monet.
Thanks very much.